Welcome to the New York Times podcast. I'm your host, John Caramonica. No music this week because this week we are speaking about something that's very serious and something that deserves quiet. And that is the current set of allegations against R. Kelly and also 18, at this point, almost a decade and a half of allegations against R. Kelly. In order to talk about what's been happening recently and also about the historical precedents for what we've been seeing in the last few months, there really is only one person to talk to, and that person is Jim DeRogatis. Hey, Jim.
Hi, John. It's an honor to be chatting with you.
I'm so happy you're here. Jim's calling in from Chicago, where he lives. And Jim is one of the hosts of Sound Opinions, which is a long-running podcast precursor. Shouts to Sound Opinions. Jim was also for many years the pop critic at the Chicago Sun-Times. And Jim is also an associate professor. He's moved on to the good life as an associate professor at Columbia College, teaching reviewing the arts. Jim, thank you again for being here. Really do appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's an important, really important subject, John.
Let's set the table a little bit for what's been happening over the last few months. Let's start with your BuzzFeed story that came out not that long ago.
Well, the first BuzzFeed story was in July. Last year, and it took me 9 months to work on it. The Washington Post had done a column. I was with three different news organizations for 3 months each.
I saw that,
You know, this Hulk Hogan, Gawker, Peter Thiel chilling of journalism, you know, it's not enough now to worry about libel. We have this new standard of the unreasonable invasion of privacy.
Right.
So it was a very hard story to place, and, you know, that entire time, I'm talking to these parents several times a week. And the story that dropped finally with BuzzFeed, some of the best, I think, First Amendment lawyers in the country today, Trump dossier, you know,
right.
And Marissa Carroll. And
they were not cowed by
They were not cowed. And it's some of the best editing and lawyering I've had in my career. And it was a story that I'm proud of.
For people who have not read it, the substance of that story is that R. Kelly, who for many years has been suspected and accused of improper sexual relations with minors and various women, is keeping women in houses in multiple cities, basically as on call for sexual availability.
The words that the parents used in police reports in Georgia are cult and brainwashed.
Right.
And I don't think cult is exactly the right word, but it's protected by the police report.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that there were six women as of last July of varying ages, the youngest 17, another 19, some older who've been with him for years, who were told when to eat, when to sleep, how to dress, who they can talk to, nobody in his circle, no friends, no family, and how to pleasure him in encounters that he records.
Right.
It's horrifying, and cult and brainwashed are the words the parents use. I had seven sources on the record,
mm-hmm.
two sets of parents, one in Florida, one in Georgia, two women who bravely spoke about what they'd experienced when they were part of Kelly's circle. They also began using the words cult. They didn't know each other. They were there at different times. They had both broken away. They were legal age, but they had seen underage girls
right.
as part of it, and a former personal assistant. And since then, there's been another six or seven sources who've come out on the record. So that was the first big story about the cult in July. The next month, there was a young woman who had cut high school class every day during his trial in 2008 for making child pornography. She was cutting her sophomore class and attending the trial. They were carding, John, at the trial,
mm-hmm.
the sheriff's officers. You had to be 21 because they were going to show the 26-minute and 39-second video of him allegedly having sex with a 14-year-old,
right.
according to the prosecutors, numerous times. They did show it numerous times during the trial. And she had a fake ID. She got in. And one of his hangers-on handed her a balled-up piece of paper, palmed it to her with his phone number, and she began a sexual relationship with him while underage a couple of months after his acquittal.
Right, and just to emphasize, that is at the trial where he
at
is
trial.
On trial for child
15
pornography
years,
charges.
15 years behind bars.
Right.
And he met and soon began a relationship with another teenager.
Before we go forward, so those two BuzzFeed pieces were basically brought R. Kelly back into the scrutiny of the spotlight after, frankly, a few relatively quiet years. When I think of the R. Kelly trial in the mid-2000s, and you think of the R. Kelly accusations of the early mid-2000s, there was a time when him and his travails were very much near the center of the public consciousness. But after the acquittal, he went through a period where he was releasing sort of decidedly non-sexual music. His career was in
there was the Black Panties album.
Well, then, yes, of course. But then there was the one I forget the name of it that was sort of like the kind of old soul record.
Yeah, the Steppin' music.
Steppin' music record. But his career was already kind of in decline.
What was really interesting to me is in 2013, Kelly began an outreach. I mean, he has always had a core Black fan base.
Yep.
And you know, aside from Space Jam and I Believe I Can Fly, it has been an almost exclusively Black fan base. And many of those people remain fans. They say, my babies were conceived to R. Kelly. I love the Steppin' music. All right. In 2013, he appeared on two subsequent weekends with Phoenix on stage at Coachella, played Bonnaroo, and headlined the Pitchfork Music Festival. So there was this very conscious attempt to reach out to the, and I'm sorry, I'm going to stereotype,
go ahead,
the craft beer drinking, bearded, graduate school hipster crowd.
That was an interesting moment because I think the early 2010s, and again, I don't like using the hipster term either, but for efficacy, we'll just stick with it. That was the beginning of an era where hipsters decided that they liked everything. They didn't just like indie rock. They didn't just like alternative country. You know, they didn't just like the sort of genres that we had all, you know, you and me, and we had all through the 90s and 2000s associated with that scene. It became a much more open-eared scene. And part of that was embracing figures like R. Kelly. Problematic past be damned.
Yeah, there was something exceedingly sinister to me, because Ryan Schreiber, you know, the major domo of Pitchfork, and Mike Reed, the African-American jazz musician who actually books the concert, they were both well aware of what Kelly meant, especially in Chicago.
In Chicago.
You know, I mean, Union Park, where he headlined, he was on stage half a mile away from where one of the first victims who filed a civil lawsuit in the mid-90s live. This is a girl who had a relationship with him at 14, 15. He picked her up in his sophomore choir class when he went back to Kenwood Academy to visit, and she slit her wrists at the end of that relationship in an attempt to kill herself. And certainly Pitchfork was aware of this, and I made them aware again in my reporting at the time. To me, there was just no excuse to embrace as hypersexualized kitsch Sex in the Kitchen and Trapped in the Closet and Sexosaurus, when you realize the very real damage,
world, right, there's real world consequences.
Right, to dozens of young women in this community in Chicago. And now, my last story for BuzzFeed a week ago, Monday, you know, a young woman in Miami, underage. And, you know, there are dozens, John, and that's the difference here. There was a very good piece that ran the same day as my last BuzzFeed story in the Washington Post by Jeff Eggers. He spent 6 or 9 months on it, where he's holding the industry accountable.
Yes.
People like Clive Calder of Jive Records, who, you know, is now retired in the Cayman Islands.
Living fat off the profits.
Living fat off the profits. The label that brought us Britney Spears and NSYNC and R. Kelly. And, you know, record company executives in Jeff's piece are saying, you know, what are we supposed to be, therapists? Are we supposed to police our artists? Well, when you've sat in settlement hearings, when you have underage women telling the most horrific stories, and these are open, you know, the first four lawsuits filed against him remain public documents.
Sure.
And why it's been a lonely beat for me for 18 years, I have never been able to understand.
Well, you do understand because you have said on multiple occasions the reason that this continues to go on, the reason that there is a lack of interest, because of who the victims are. Society
young
does
black
not
men,
value...
Yeah.
Black people, society's not value women, society's not value
yeah.
young people, and certainly society's not value young black women at the level that it would value young white women, young white men.
Well, and I, you know, and I want to underscore, John, that when I've said that, nobody matters less in our society than young black women, I'm repeating the young black women, all right? I am amplifying what they've said to me for 18 years.
Sure.
You know, I'm a fat 53-year-old white rock critic with Feelies, Savages, and Can tattoos on my arms, okay? I don't feel like I have the right to speak for young black women. I'm just amplifying what they've said to
sure.
me again and again and again. And great friends and scholars like Mark Anthony Neal,
of course.
You know, wonderful African-American scholar and great R&B critic. You know, he's always said, he said to me 15 years ago, you know, Jim, if it had been one white girl in Winnetka,
yep.
Chicago suburb that
it'd
gave
us
Liz Phair, it would have been a different story. Yep. So I'm not speaking for the black community.
No, but I think that that is a fair broad spectrum assessment. I want to go back. I want to go back to 2000 because, and I think at this point, I want to situate a little bit where you were in your career at
sure.
the time. So you'd been at the Sun-Times at that point for how many years?
Well, you know, I did round one at the Sun-Times, and then I went back to New York to work as a deputy music
right.
editor
That's
of Rolling Stone.
Yes.
Got myself fired for panning Hootie and the Blowfish. And
Unforgivable, Jim. Darius
where
Rucker's,
is where Darius, is Hootie today?
Hey, Darius Rucker's a legend.
He's playing golf, and he's making a lot of money in country, I know.
Godspeed.
But I'm still here, too. And then I went back to the Sun-Times. So I was in my second round as the Sun-Times pop music critic. You know, I had covered R. Kelly from the beginning of his career. It's a great story.
Had you interviewed R. Kelly prior to 2000?
Yeah, briefly. He got nominated for some Grammys early on. I think it was the second album or the first album. You know, and they trotted him out at the local press conference on Grammy nomination day. And, you know, it was a year or two when I started covering him since he had graduated from public announcement.
Right.
And a year before that, he'd been literally busking on the L platforms for change
mm-hmm.
and singing at backyard barbecues. Wayne Williams, a Jive Records talent yep. scout, famously heard him singing at a backyard barbecue on the South Side. So it was almost overnight that 12 Play makes him a superstar. Hypersexualized from the beginning. And, you know, John, I don't even know where, but as a music critic in Chicago, and I'm sure it was true for you in New York, you know, it was just always in the air. R. Kelly likes them young. And I'm putting air quotes
mm-hmm.
around that.
Mm-hmm.
R. Kelly likes them young. What does that mean? Well, Vibe magazine had published mm-hmm. what appeared to be a falsified Cook County
marriage license.
Right. Listing Kelly's age accurately and Aaliyah's as 18 when, in fact, she was 15. So that was in the air. And, you know, I interviewed Kelly once at that Grammy press conference. I'm covering his album. TP2.com comes out. You know, remember when there were Tuesday release dates? I get it Friday, and I review it for Tuesday's Chicago Sun-Times.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day, or that morning, actually, that it was in the paper, I got a fax. And it was anonymous letters that, Dear Jim, today you reviewed R. Kelly, you compared him to Marvin Gaye. Well, Marvin had his problems, but they're nothing like R. Kelly's. He's been under investigation by the Sex Crimes Unit of the Chicago Police Department for 2 years. There's been these lawsuits filed. And I will confess, John, despite being, you know, a beat and investigative reporter in Jersey City and Hoboken, I threw that fax on the corner of my desk and I said, player hater, trying to down, you know, the black superstar. But I had been a reporter for 5 years.
Right. And that's sort of what I wanted to talk about, because obviously I think certainly in so much as I was trained over the years, I was trained as a critic. I was not trained as a reporter. I know you had a reporting background. If you could talk a little bit about taking one hat off to put the other hat on, I'd love to hear about that
sure.
from a professional perspective. I think it's a little different for people who are younger, who the lines are a lot blurrier on the internet. But I think for people of my generation and older generations, those walls were often pretty high.
John, don't sell yourself short. Every critic has to first be a reporter. So, you know, I was a good reporter in New Jersey, and I was lucky, I think, to then go on to be a rock critic. But you are first a reporter always. And there was something that bothered me about that fax. It sat on my desk for a day or two, player hater. There was a Polish cop's name in the sex crimes unit.
Mm-hmm.
So I called the CPD and I said, you know, can I speak to Sergeant whoever? And she got on the phone. And I said, you know, asking about R. Kelly. Oh, finally, huh? I can't talk to you. And she hung up. And I said, okay. All right. So there's I walked across the room. Yeah. I'm in the features section, right. You know. We're back there by the horoscopes and the right. comics. And I walked over to the city desk, and I said to the city editor, I think there's something here. And he paired me with the courts reporter, Abden right. Palish. So Abden and I start ringing doorbells on the south side.
Right.
And we found this lawsuit. And, you know, I mean, it's a great story as a reporter. The first lawsuit against Kelly by an underage woman who he picked up at the choir class at Kenwood Academy. You know, his mentor was Lena McClain.
Yes.
And she was the goddaughter of the Reverend Thomas A. Dorsey, the founder of gospel music. Mm-hmm. And he'd go back to those sophomores and he'd pick them up and begin sexual relationships with them, allegedly, according to lawsuits.
When you guys were doing the doorbell ringing, how quickly did it all start to come together?
Really, as soon as we found that lawsuit, Kelly tried to head off that first lawsuit with a countersuit. And that was reported in the New York Daily News, the gossip column of the Daily News, and in the gossip column of the Sun Times. R. Kelly's being shaken down by a woman who's, you know, trying to get money out of him, right? And the actual lawsuit, you know, his counterclaim was like 3 pages long, and the actual lawsuit was like 100 pages, mm-hmm. and it was harrowing, the amount of detail and the corroborating witnesses. So that girl had settled with a nondisclosure agreement, the Harvey Weinstein tool. And there's dozens of these through the years. And so, you know, I can't say whether she ever talked to us or not. I'm mm-hmm. not going to break her confidentiality, but certainly the witnesses were fair game, her friends. And I stumbled onto a great source who had been with Kelly for a very long time in a key position. And the annulment of the Aaliyah marriage and Aaliyah's legal claim against him had been sealed in Detroit. She went to the Detroit High School of Performing Arts. Mm-hmm. She lived in Detroit. They were sealed by the court, but those documents were provided to me and Abden.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a harrowing document, non-disclosure agreement on both her part and Kelly's, and vowing not to pursue further legal claims for physical abuse. So it wasn't just an underage sexual relationship. He hit her, yeah. allegedly, according to that court document.
Right.
Now, Aaliyah, you know, is beloved. She was not eager to talk about it. The industry was not eager to talk about it. Whatever happened with her and Kelly, well, you know, we know what happened. We had the annulment. It was a falsified certificate. He got married in a suite in near O'Hare Airport, got on a plane to Florida. We're going to have a honeymoon. Got off the plane, and by that time, her uncle, Kelly's manager,
Barry
Hankerson, yeah. legendary character, managed Tony Braxton, made Kelly a star. He paired Kelly with his niece, Aaliyah, and Kelly rewarded him with this sexual relationship. The family, Uncle Barry, separated Kelly and Aaliyah. So this is hours after the wedding, but the sexual relationship was ongoing, all of my sources have said, throughout the making of AJ Nothing But a Number. The first story was that first lawsuit, a couple of other sources who corroborated that this behavior was ongoing. Lena McClain saying, you know, there was never any hanky-panky in my class. What happened afterwards, I don't know. And the Aaliyah stuff.
Can you contextualize? Because obviously if a story of that nature came out today, that person would be canceled in social media. That person would probably be brought up on charges. Like the way that a story of that nature would ricochet today is very different from what happened in 2000. I remember reading it and I remember the conversations around it, but there wasn't a broader sense of something will happen now.
No, you know, it was essentially crickets. Somebody asked me that yesterday, you know, that was their word. I thought it was pretty good. The Associated Press and the UPI picked it up, and every paper in the country ran a couple of paragraphs that said the Chicago Sun-Times is reporting that R. Kelly abuses his position of wealth and fame to pursue illegal underage sexual relationships. And, you know, Kelly threatened to sue the Sun-Times. That never happened, denied everything, and it was quiet. It was a big to-do in Chicago on, you know, R&B radio, on television. Then it was crickets for a year. That's December of 2000. The next Thanksgiving, I began hearing, well, there were two tapes.
Exactly. The second tape is the one that ends up being the trigger.
The second, the first tape came and we didn't know what it was. We couldn't confirm who the girl was, and we'd given it to police. I really want to underscore that it was always me and Abden Palish and the city editors of the Sun-Times and the lawyers and the top editors. So Jim DeRogatis didn't make the decision to give two videotapes to police. You know, it's a journalistic ethical question.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the first tape, I don't believe we even reported it because we did not know for sure who the girl was and how old she was. And about a year after that first story, I started to hear of a second videotape on the street. And then one day I got a call at home. I was working at home. Go to your mailbox. Click. And I went to my mailbox and there was a manila envelope and it was a videotape. And I'd heard rumors of this girl when I was reporting the first story. And I called her aunt. Her aunt was the recording artist, Sparkle, who had, you know, one of the few other women that Kelly actually recorded, you know, like Aaliyah. But her record really went nowhere. And when I called her for that December 2000 story, she said, "How dare you ask me this? You're talking about my my baby niece. You're talking about my sister's daughter. F you." And hung up on me. And now I called her and she said, "Oh my God," she'd come to me first and said, "I couldn't talk to you a year ago. Now I hear there's a videotape on the street." When I had the tape in hand, I called her. And so within a couple of hours of getting the tape, I was down at the Sun-Times. Sparkle came in, watched the tape with me, and was in tears. That's my niece. She was 14 or 15 at the time. I know by the way she wears her hair. And, you know, she left and we gave the tape to police. So, it, you know, it was all like a couple, 3-4 hours. It was insane. And then we began doing our reporting, too. So that's the videotape story. And then it took 6 months, and then he got indicted on 21 counts of making
so obviously that story actually had tangible, real-world consequences.
Yeah, not only that, but when the indictment was served, he was in Florida. And the Florida cops walked in to serve the indictment, arrest him, and extradite him to Chicago. It's 21 counts originally. It gets reduced to 14 counts. But the Florida police walked in and found all these video cameras set up. And so they confiscated them. Now, you call, you know, you call the cops because it smells like your neighbor next door is making meth. And they walk in and they also find, you know, a pound of weed in full view. You know, it's like he's going to get busted for that, too, right? Well, the cops in Florida took these cameras and found more images of Kelly with more underage girls and the girl on the videotape we'd given to police. But that was kicked out by the Florida courts. It was kicked out as unreasonable search and seizure. And that's part of the story that, like, I mean, you know, there's many, 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 many corroborating parts of this story that, that often get left out in the, you know, quick telling. But, so he dodged the Florida bullet.
And eventually was put. He went on trial in Chicago and was...
Six years. It was the longest case in Chicago history, going to trial.
And was acquitted, despite overwhelming evidence. What seems like...
Yeah, there were more than a dozen witnesses confirmed the identity of the girl and her age. But the girl didn't testify, never appeared in court, neither did her mother or father. And so the jury's conclusion was, we never heard from a victim. We can't be certain. This is rape culture at its most pathetic.
Sure.
Judge Gowen would immediately retire to close chambers. So 90% of what happened in the trial, the six-year wait, happened in closed chambers and the records were sealed. The Chicago Sun-Times, the Chicago Tribune, and WBEZ, Chicago Public Radio, sued and went to the appellate court, went to the Supreme Court. And they were reluctant to overturn Vincent Gowen. And then I believe what was happening was he was methodically ruling out evidence of anything other than the videotape.
Mm.
None of the civil lawsuits, which were public record, none of those four lawsuits, none of the non-disclosure agreements and out-of-court settlements, none of the money trail. So no evidence except 26 minutes and 39 seconds of videotape, which was shown half a dozen times. But he was acquitted. That judge today is trying a police officer who shot an African-American kid named Laquan McDonald 16 times.
Same judge.
Same judge. And he also compelled a reporter to testify about the source of the police video that he made public. And he is doing the same thing with holding the trial in camera. stealing the records. This is a bad actor on the bench.
I want to talk a little bit about not just the personal toll that this work has taken on you over the years, but I also am curious to talk subsequent to that about how it's changed your relationship to the other work that you do, your criticism, your teaching, et cetera. But maybe start with the personal stuff.
There were a lot of sleepless nights. There was a stomach ailment, you know, the calls in the middle of the night and the calls on Christmas. And when you're talking about young women who are sharing with you that they have been sexually victimized and traumatized, and parents of those women and sources who are speaking out because they believe what they saw is wrong and they're afraid. You know, look, for me to talk about that, I got no right. You know what I mean? I am a rock critic. I am firmly in favor of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. My first book, it came out in two different editions, Kaleidoscope Eyes, Turn On Your Mind, is a celebration of psychedelic rock. Journey toward the white light, brother. All right? I am a hedonist, okay? Rock and roll is hedonism. But do what thou will is the whole of the law, Led Zeppelin quoting Aleister Crowley, so long as ye shall harm none. You want to have sex with a goat? The goat consents? Go, do it, whatever. But this is not that. This is a predatory behavior. This is not rock and roll groupie culture. I've read Hammer of the Gods, all right? If we are going to impose a moral litmus test on every artist, especially in popular music, forget it. You know, I mean, there will be no art.
Right.
I think the dividing line that I've come across, and what I encourage my students, what I encourage listeners, what I encourage everyone who cares, is the art about the misdeeds? And really, in popular music, I can only think of a handful of examples. Michael Jackson's last two albums, the ones we don't listen to, right? Because it's Off the Wall is the masterpiece, and of course, Thriller is Thriller, right? But the last two albums of his career, Invincible and History, are full of songs talking about his trials, two of them, in California for sex with underage boys. I would get hate mail. We're very close in Chicago to Gary, Indiana. You know, Jackson Genesis. I would get hate mail whenever I reviewed those last records and mentioned the accusations against him. But it's like, wait a minute. If the artist is singing about them, then it's fair game for me to write about them in my criticism of those albums. And in my view, Kelly's discography
is essentially that.
It is an unfettered view of hedonism where I will pursue my pleasures however I so desire. And when you realize that that means dozens of young women in lawsuits, in off-the-record settlements, in court, in the sealed documents with Aaliyah have accused him of this running back to the mid-90s,
I think that's an interesting framework to kind of encourage people to think about art through. I think I've been trying to think about maybe a parallel framework, which is it's tough sometimes, I feel, for you or I or a critic to say this art is definitively about this misdeed. But I think a lot about the systems that are set up to support artists. And by that, I mean record labels, touring companies, in the current economy, streaming companies and such. And I think about the bigger picture. And when I write about art made by people who have done problematic things in their real life or who are alleged to have done problematic things about their real life, I feel like sometimes it's helpful to draw attention to the systems that continue to let those artists be placed in front of us. And I think obviously what you saw with what happened with Spotify is an example of a formerly politically neutral company coming out and saying, okay, we're taking a stand, albeit a conflicted and not fully thought through one, but we are taking a stand. I wonder if you can talk a little bit, and I think the Washington Post report on Kelly gets at some of this too by talking to people who worked with him and worked with the companies that worked with him. Can you talk a little bit about their responsibilities and how we should hold them to account?
I think, again, that Kelly is a truly singular case, because since the mid-90s, since 12 Play, there are literally hundreds of enablers, publicists, record company middle people, DJs,
radio stations,
video, tape ops in recording studios, receptionists, hundreds of people who saw this behavior. And I've heard from dozens, and I know just exponentially how many more. They saw underage girls. They saw physical abuse, alleged. They saw, women not being allowed to speak to anybody but him, told what to do, how to dress, who to talk to, what, you know, this was, hundreds of people knew about this behavior, and nobody stopped it. And some people put up with it for X number of years and then walked away and became sources to me and Abdon, to Jeff Eggers of the Washington Post. And others, left and didn't become sources when the money dried up or when maybe they walked away from conscience, but they took that money for a very long time. And I think eventually that's going to be a reckoning for the music industry. Because, again, this is predatory behavior. These are not isolated incidents. We see a lot of horrible stuff in rock and roll. People treated badly. And, rock and roll, I mean, all of popular music. This isn't new. Frank Sinatra did it, and somebody's doing it tonight. But, again, I don't know of the scope of this misbehavior.
Right.
Being so tremendous. 60 million records sold, and hundreds of people being witness to it and doing nothing.
Do you feel that the next wave of reporting on Kelly and figures like Kelly is going to take that form, though, of starting to hold to task the enablers?
No.
You don't?
No, I don't think so. I think Jeff Eggers' piece was a singularly unique piece because nobody's followed it up today. And, nobody's probing Apple, Spotify, Pandora all that hard. I mean, they're removing Kelly from playlists. But the albums are still available to stream.
Right.
Certainly, RCA Records refuses to make any comment. There was a piece in Variety about 2 weeks ago. Are they going to just let his contract lapse? Look, you've sold 60 million albums, right? And the time to comment on this behavior is now. Whether it's a fear of legal ramifications or I don't know what it is, John. I am troubled somewhat. I'm troubled by censorship of any sort. I'm a free speech absolutist. I was ready to go to jail for it. I don't even like the idea that Pandora and Spotify and Apple are taking him off a playlist. I'm not even sure that's right. I'm troubled. I respect the activists enormously. Kenyette Barnes, Tish Barnes, I've interviewed her. She's thanked me, and I've thanked her. I respect them enormously. But even the phrase, mute R. Kelly, I don't want to mute anybody. I don't want to censor anybody. I think each of us have to wrestle with that art and the artist separating thing. But I also think there's, people are being hurt. What's different right now about Kelly from Harvey Weinstein and Kevin Spacey and Matt Lauer? I've said this before, Lauer allegedly had a button under his desk at NBC and he would lock women in and he would attack them, allegedly. If you are walking by that locked door and you hear someone scream and you keep walking, that's what the world is doing right now. These parents in Georgia, these parents in Florida are saying that their daughters are being held, brainwashed in a cult, and law enforcement in Georgia, Florida, and Illinois have done nothing. The FBI has done nothing. There have been hours and hours of interviews with every source that I've reported and others giving their statements to law enforcement, those five organizations, because it's, Olympia Fields Police and Chicago Police here in Chicago and Georgia and Florida, and nobody's doing anything. Saturday night, my phone started to explode, and the parents from Florida came to Chicago. And they were standing in front of Kelly's recording studio, rented recording studio, where he allegedly houses these girls when he's in town. He lives in Trump Tower himself, but the girls are housed in the recording studio. It is half a block from where he headlined Pitchfork at Union Park. The parents from Florida are there. They are arguing with the guys in the black SUV or black sedan that is present in front of the studio 24/7. They were screaming and yelling and demanding to see their daughter. Four or five Chicago squad cars arrived, police. Police seemed to be very friendly with Kelly's security. They seemed to know Kelly's security. They refused to do a well-being check. They refused to take a report of any kind. threaten the Florida parents with arrest if they didn't leave immediately.
Horrible.
And I zoomed over there, and I caught the tail end of this. The goons were still outside, the security, and I sat with those parents for an hour. And they were furious and ranting and raving, and they were also emotional and crying. And I sat with them, all right? And then I went and I played punk rock. And boy, did I need it, okay? And on Sunday, on Mother's Day, I called the head of communications for the Chicago Police Department. And I said I had witnessed part of this, and I had interviewed these parents about this. Are you aware of Chicago police officers who work part-time off-duty as R. Kelly security? And the answer was, police can take any job they want in their off-duty hours, and they do not have to report it to Chicago Police Department. Now, at the my wife works at the Chicago Tribune. My radio partner works at the Chicago Tribune. If Greg Todd or my wife want to do a freelance article, they have to get clearance from their editors at the Tribune. But you're a cop in Chicago. You don't have to ask, is it okay for me to do security for a gangbanger? Is it okay for me to do security for the mob? Is it okay for me to do security for R. Kelly? All right, so that's my Saturday, John, you know, last week. I don't think this story's over. Those girls are there. That girl from Florida who started the relationship at 17, she's been there 3 years. That girl from Georgia who started the relationship at 19, she's been there 2.5 years. The one girl just walked away, got away, and is back home. I called her N in my last BuzzFeed story. And her mother was on the record, but we did not name her because she's a sexual assault victim, and I have not spoken to her. She could not be reached while she was part of Kelly's circle. She is now home with her mother. But there apparently are two young women besides the Florida and Georgia girls still there. And they're legal age, all right? So they're legal age. They can do what they want, even if the relationship started underage. But that's not what the parents are saying. Parents say, yeah, we know well and good. We haven't heard from our daughter in 3 years. No phone calls, no visits, no nothing. She dropped out of college and disappeared. And I don't know, cult and brainwashed. Those are the words the parents use.
I want to thank you, again, not just for the work that you've done, but I also want to thank you for coming on and sharing some of what you've been dealing with for the last 18 years and for continuing to bring this story to light.
Oh, I appreciate your interest, John.
That's our show this week. Really grateful to Jim for coming on and sharing his stories and for continuing to bring light to the R. Kelly news events and for being vigilant over 18 years, which is just an invaluable service. So thanks to Jim. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. You can email us at podcast@nytimes.com. Subscribe to us at Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, anywhere you get your audio content. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. Catch us next week.